The rest is confetti.
Hello, and welcome back to the monologue. Yay!
Hi, everybody.
Welcome back.
Here at the monologue, we take a thematic deep dive into the works of Mike Flanagan, exploring recurring motifs, creative processes, and collaborations in the Flaniverse. And of course, the monologue. My name is Cecilia. I'm joined by my co-hosts, Riley and Kelsey. Say hello.
Hi, hello. Everybody.
Welcome back. Back today, at it again.
Today we've got a full monologue episode for you, and we're going to be talking specifically just about a monologue. So we're going to be breaking down Nell's monologue from The Haunting of Hill House, the confetti monologue. So spoilers, if you have not seen The Haunting of Hill House, we're going to just... Every episode is pretty much a full spoiler episode, but I feel like we should start saying that there are spoilers. Yeah.
Just although, in case, I mean, it is your first episode. Spoilers, spoilers, spoilers.
Yeah, but also the Haunting of Hill House has been out since 2018. So exactly. I would say if you have not watched it at this point, you need to just pause this podcast and go watch it. Because
Yeah,
you need
it's
to see
it. It's been out since 1959. Pick up a book, dummy.
Also, this is probably Mike Flanagan's most popular work, so I feel like if you're listening to a Mike Flanagan podcast, this is probably, out of everything, his piece of media that you have seen.
And it's definitely the ones that, like, your random relative who always watches what's trending on Netflix has seen. So, yeah, I think this is definitely his most overall popular, well-liked, most accessible work as well. So I think it's a good place to start with our, you know, we're finally out of our little soft launch, and now we're talking about the monologues like we promised we would.
Yeah. For those of you who haven't seen The Haunting of Hill House, the TV show is on Netflix. It's based on Shirley Jackson's book, The Haunting of Hill House. It's an adaptation.
I mean, it is significantly different than the book. So if you're a Shirley Jackson person thinking like, well, I haven't seen the show, but I've read the novel, like you're going to need to see the show because it's substantially different.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I would say, less of an adaptation of, more of an inspired by, or like a reframing, because it does have technically the same characters. Like, there's Luke and Nell and Theo, but they're now siblings, and there are some new characters as well. There's a reference to the Crane family, who, if you've read the book, you know Hugh Crane and that guy and his creepy demon pictures and stuff. So it's more of a, I don't want to say fan fiction, but it almost feels like it has the, like, kind of same tropes and stuff that a fan fiction would have. It's of like, oh, this character has this name and it's a nod to, you know?
It's like a spiritual successor. Like, it takes kind of the essence of the original, but it's a wholly different story.
Yeah, I think a reframing, a reimagining, keeping the same themes, keeping a couple of the same things, like the names of the characters, the house, is where you see a lot of the similarities. And of course, I think a lot of this is done not only because it's an adaptation of a sort, but also because it's a limited series. So it's not a, you know, Robert Wise movie that's going to be an hour and a half. It's I don't remember how many episodes, eight episodes?
Ten episodes? Because eight is the one where Theo has the breakdown monologue, nine is screaming memes, and then 10 is where everything is resolved.
Yeah, so, all right, that's a quick get your feet wet into Haunting of Hill House if somehow you have not seen it.
But if you haven't seen it, stop what you're doing and go watch it. You're gonna like it, I promise.
Yeah, it's really, really good. So the monologue. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, like, I don't think anyone that I know who has seen it has disliked it. And whenever I mention other Flanagan things, especially lately, telling people about The Life of Chuck, and I'll say like, oh, it was made by like Mike Flanagan. People are like, oh, the Haunting of Hill House guy, yeah. Which I don't know how he would feel about being known like that. But the fact that people instantly recognize that is a good thing, I would say.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it'll lead him to more stuff, and then it'll eventually be like, oh, the Dark Tower guy, and just, you know.
Someday. Oh my gosh.
Someday soon.
It's coming someday.
Yeah.
I don't remember what episode, or we were talking, I think it was during one of our mini monologues, we were talking about like Flana pitches, and we were just talking about doing Rebecca, and like we were talking about having to get the rights, and that's kind of how I feel about, I'm assuming, what Dark Tower must be like. Getting the rights for everything must be a fucking pain and a nightmare.
Can I make a not so subtle plug for something that's related to that?
Of course.
Oh my god, yeah.
If you have been watching the show regularly, you were introduced to Eric Vespi, who is a guest on our Life of Chuck show. He is my fiance, but he's known for running a podcast called The Kingcast. And in the lead up to The Life of Chuck, they did a series of interviews with stars from The Life of Chuck, and then an episode with Mike Flanagan. And in that episode, he spends a decent amount of time talking about the current situation with the Dark Tower. So if your ears perked up when Riley said Dark Tower and you want to know what is going on with it, you can hear the latest information about the challenges and the things that are occurring in that realm, but it is not dead.
That's awesome, because I haven't heard the episode yet, and I hadn't heard an update, because I've heard, you know, there have been more Carrie updates lately than anything, which is also very exciting.
Yes.
But it's nice, too. We were actually just talking about Dark Tower last night. My girlfriend was asking about if there were any. So we'll have to listen to that episode today. That is awesome.
It is very much alive, but not anything that would be worth putting in headlines. So that's just why it's been quiet.
Okay.
But yes, that information is available on the Kingcast podcast.
Awesome. And thank you. Shout out to Eric. Shout out to the Kingcast. Find them. They're somewhere.
All right. Okay, so back to, sorry for derailing.
No, that was a great plug.
Yes, thank you.
And very related to what we were talking about. Whoa. So the monologue we're going to be talking about today from The Haunting of Hill House is probably the most notable monologue, I would say, from the show. It's definitely got, I feel like, one of the most quoted lines from Mike Flanagan. And this monologue happens in the last episode?
Episode, I believe it's in episode 10, yes.
Everyone comes back to the house.
Forgiveness is warm, like a tear on a cheek. Think of that and of me when you stand in the rain. I loved you completely. And you loved me the same. That's all. The rest is confetti.
Man, that makes me so teary-eyed every time I hear it.
Every single time.
Nell's monologue here has such similar themes to what Mike talks about in The Life of Chuck. It really is beautiful.
Before we move on to anything, anyone who hasn't seen this show, a lot going on in that scene. Maybe we should do a quick little summary, because there's a guy dying on the floor. There's a tea party happening. There's a ghost wandering around in the room. A lot going on.
So the show is framed in two timelines that are happening at the same time. We have the past, which is the kids you just saw, them as children, the siblings, and then them in what you just saw in the present day. And the show revolves around Nell, who is the character speaking and giving the monologue, her passing, and then them reflecting on their mother's passing. And there's a lot of ghosts, and the houses might be supernatural. And so the scene we saw happens at the end, where they all make it back to the house because the brother who's laying on the floor, the house is trying to eat, essentially. And it's them coming together. at the end. I don't know if that's a great summary, but
I think it kind of sums it up. The guy's got a heroin addiction. That's a big part of the story and why we're kind of all coming together as siblings, because Nell also has, you know, killed herself. They've got to figure out, find him for the funeral. So that's kind of how we got here, at least.
Nell is a ghost in this.
Yes, Nell has passed away, and we have seen her dead body at this point, so we know for sure that she is a ghost. So the supernatural is confirmed real, because I think in an adaptation like this, you kind of have to choose one or the other. Like, the haunting film and the book itself, it's really easy to leave that ambiguous, but I think making a hard stance was right for this series.
And another thing about this monologue that is kind of important is, if you've watched the series all the way through, this is like a big plot twist moment, because throughout the series, you keep seeing the siblings in when they were younger, like in the earlier time period, in all these different rooms. And you don't really think about it at the time, because it's like, it's a huge house. Like, there could be a treehouse, there could be a game room, a playroom, a dance studio, like all these other things. So finding out in this moment that none of those really existed, it was like the house, like, putting on different shapes that maybe like only some of them could see. So that's kind of like a whoa, like, that's crazy, like when you're finishing watching the series the first time.
Which is so funny, because episode 6, I think, Two Storms, is basically one long shot through the house, and you still, but it's during the storm, there's so much chaos. If you wanted to, you could map out that house and be like, okay, I kind of know where everything is now. There's not enough room. And it still, I think, has blown everyone's mind that I have talked to. It's just, it's so well done, and like all of the twists and turns are just like revealed perfectly and set up perfectly.
Well, because even in Two Storms, we really only see like one, you go up the stairs and like to the right. So feasibly all those other rooms could exist like to the left.
I guess that is true. Yeah.
I think the thing about this monologue too is it really just summarizes all of the themes of the show very well. Like the theme of time, of death, of memory. I mean, the whole theme of, like, what confetti represents, I think is also why people remember it so well. It's also just really beautifully performed by Victoria Pedretti. Shout out. She is fantastic in this.
Which, I mean, I'd heard this before, but her performance is part of the reason why the rest is confetti as a line stayed in there. When I went back to kind of look up the monologue and refresh my memory today, I came across a like Tumblr blog that Mike Flanagan wrote years ago at this point, where someone kind of asked him about that monologue. And so he goes really in depth about the process of filming and like the whole, so before the clip that we showed you, Nell comes in and she's saying pieces of that monologue, but they're out of order and they don't really make sense. And he says in there that like that was kind of inspired by, so anytime you film something, you don't necessarily film in order. But because this was his first TV show, there were a lot of different production companies, I believe, that were working together on this one. And so there was a lot more of revisiting certain scenes or certain sets than there normally would be. And so he said when he was writing this monologue, he kind of felt like he was in an existence where time was not linear. And so that's where that came from. And then also the confetti line, I'd heard before that like he wasn't sure if it would seem a little too cutesy to keep in, but the way that Victoria Pedretti acted it, that's why they decided to keep it. But something I learned today is that, so he had also considered say having her like talk more about, which I, this is in the monologue a little bit listening to it, about how our moments kind of fall around us like rain, but he thought that was like too small and too uniform. And then he'd originally thought of like having her talk about like snowflakes because those can be different sizes and they kind of flurry around. But he thought that would be too, like, plain, I guess. I can't think of the word that he used.
Yeah.
I feel like that's, it's kind of used a lot because of the, uniqueness of the,
And I'm going to guess from Riley's reaction, and then we'll go back to your thought, Kelsey. Did you leave that? Did you ask Mike that question? You just heard smiling, Riley. But, so I was that seems like something you would have done.
No. Shout out.
Oh, because
to
of the Tumblr. Yeah.
Because I'm the person, and we can I can find the screenshot somewhere, but I'm the one who convinced Mike to get on Tumblr because everyone was migrating from Twitter, and he was like, I'm gonna get on Mastodon. And I was like, but what if you didn't?
I think it was technically the Horrorstruck account, though. So technically both of you get credit for that.
It was the man behind the mask that did it.
Anyways, not to interrupt you.
I'm just a little proud of myself.
Kelsey, please continue. All right,
I saw your face, and I was thinking that's what you were thinking about. Because you weren't the person who asked the question on Tumblr. I would have mentioned that if you were.
No, I asked, I think the only thing I asked Mike on there was about the student Masters? Films that he did. Oh, and maybe one day we can have Mike on to talk about them, because I don't think otherwise we're getting any access to
I may be in possession
those.
Of Ghosts of Hamilton.
Oh, Street. Ghosts of Hamilton Street's rad. If you can find it, do it. I think Mike would be okay with it.
So back to the monologue. Yes. So Rain did not work. It was like too small and too uniform. Snowflakes was like a little too drab and plain and overused, like Riley said. And so something that I did not realize until today was he was thinking back to Violet McGraw, who plays Little Nell, and kind of if she were the one that was like explaining the how things were nonlinear, a word that she might use that would be a little more like childlike and joyful. And that's where he came up with confetti.
Because Mike loves clowns.
So it was, he wrote it in the script and he still wasn't sure if it was going to work. And he says in the Tumblr blog, I don't know why I'm essentially retelling this because everyone can find it online. But anyway, he says in the Tumblr blog, he even showed it to Kate and he's like, do you think this could work? And she was like, well, I don't know. It's going to depend on the acting. And because of the way the Victoria Pedretti portrayed it, where it's like very, it comes across as very like heartfelt and joyful. She has that little smile when she says that line, that's why it worked and why it stayed in. So basically if someone else had been cast as Nell, it might've just ended with like, I loved you completely, or like you loved me completely and I loved you the same. That's all that matters. Like it would have ended there. So because of her performance, we got that line that is now, if you look up Haunting of Hill House tattoos, I would say probably 90% of them are that line.
I was going to say the exact same thing, because Cecilia and I have been talking about getting matching Hill House tattoos at some point. I'm like, we have to avoid doing that because everyone does that.
Maybe what we need to do is do like a little cup of stars.
I think we need to do a Bly one, actually, is what we need to do.
I do love Bly.
Yeah, that's not as done, but we're big fans. Oh. But also, back to that, what you said, if anyone else had been cast as Nell other than Victoria Pedretti, I don't think the show would have been nearly as successful, because she is the heart of that show. If you don't cast her perfectly, it falls apart.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, yeah. I'm going to a little plug for Kate Siegel's performance in Haunting of Hill House. I still believe that she should have gotten an award nomination for her breakdown monologue. But yes, like,
oh yeah, Kate's
Victoria Pedretti did a great job. So many people in this show did a great job.
This whole show got overlooked.
Yeah, the fact that it did not get award nomination still baffles me.
Probably because it's technically a horror show, and award shows hate horror shows.
The acting in it is just like, so many people give like such amazing performances, and I'm still mad about that.
I'm also.
If Hamish Linklater didn't win for Midnight Mass, then I have no hope for horror. It has slowly been getting better with The Substance winning and, you know, Jordan Peele movies are more, acceptable. I can't think of the right word. We've been
more award show friendly.
I am majorly crossing my fingers about, I won't spoil it because I know that the movie just came out, but Mark Hamill's monologue in Life of Chuck. I hope that that gets nominated for something.
He was so much.
That performance was just,
there's so much good stuff in Life of Chuck. I think the only thing that hurts Life of Chuck is the fact that it's coming out in the summer.
Fact that it came out the same time as the live action adaptation, which I put in quotes because, like, we don't have live action dragons for How to Train Your Dragon. Because a lot of movie theaters are, like, devoting, like, all of their screens or, like, a big chunk of their screens to How to Train Your Dragon. So that kind of annoys me. But I mean, it can still, I still think that that performance is hopefully going to get nominated.
And if not, it's going to become a cult classic and we'll all talk about it. I've well, at like least Dr. heard. Sleep.
Exactly.
Okay.
Like Dr. Sleep was considered.
Like Doctor's, oh, like Dr. When Sleep. It came yes, out. Yes, yes, yes.
But now everybody is like, it's a masterpiece. So
because it is.
Chuck, yeah. The Life of Chuck will be viewed even if. Even if it in the box office is not great, it will be viewed, I think, as a masterpiece because it is.
Do you remember?
It will live on in our hearts.
Or I guess not remember this. We weren't alive when it came out, but it's like the, when The Shining first came out, and everyone's just like, "Give it a like, it's the worst movie ever made." Boo.
I love how you're like, remember when that came out, and then proceeded to tell us about a movie that came out before we were born.
I phrased it weird. I was like, hold on, let me backtrack.
We remember because.
But I heard about that on the KingCast. They were talking about it. Mm-hmm.
Shout out to the KingCast again. Everything comes back to the KingCast.
Shall we go and talk a little bit more about confetti?
Yes.
I want to talk about. Because we just said something about time and it being nonlinear. And I feel like that's also a very big part of this monologue. It has kind of got that concept of, like, time is a flat circle.
Mm-hmm. Well,
especially with the way that it's, like, paced with, because you do get those little sprinkles of confetti or, you know. Because Nell starts saying something about, like, no, the stomach. And you're like, what the fuck is this lady talking about? And then when it finally comes together and they're responding, it's like they've gone through this motion before. So it might not necessarily be the first time that Nell is having this conversation. Like, I don't know. I find that very interesting. We've been, my girlfriend and I have been talking about just what we think about time and about, like, eventually if the earth ends, is there going to be another big bang and it all repeats itself? And it almost felt kind of like that.
Yeah, that is interesting. I think this monologue is relating time to memory. Mm-hmm. And like when you remember something, your memories are not in order. They're kind of scattered like confetti. And I think it kind of fits in as well because like in the end, it reminds me a lot of when I'm contemplating like, is it worth stressing myself out over this one thing? Like, do I go do a fun thing or do I stay in because I'm tired? And like, sometimes you do because you needed to recharge. But then other times I'm like, I'm not going to remember that night that I slept in because I needed to, because I just couldn't be around people. I'm going to remember like going out with people, the times we had. And I think that's really what, you know, the rest is just confetti is all about. Because in the end, those little things in life, the little things that happen every day don't matter. It's the moments. It's like Life of Chuck. It's each other and the love we have for each other and the things that bring us together in community that we really remember in the end.
I like didn't realize like how closely this monologue feels tied to Life of Chuck until we started like analyzing it. And now I'm like, oh my gosh, like all of my comments are related to Life of Chuck.
They're kind of like sister films in a way, like, but different genres.
Yeah. It's okay. You know what that reminds me of actually is the movies, my favorite movie in the whole world, Pan's Labyrinth, and The Devil's Backbone are technically sibling films, but I think Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, which is a way different genre, I think it would fit in that, like, it would make a perfect trilogy. And it kind of reminds me of that, of like just the, it's like Mike's life trilogy. Of like, these are the kind of through lines. But that's why I've always said that I think Haunting of Hill House has a happy ending. Because of like this speech that Nell gives, And the same with Life of Chuck, which is just like this insanely optimistic film. And if you look at them, you know, subjectively, they're so, so, so different.
Well, arguably, I think Haunting of Hill House does have a happy ending. Spoiler alert. Although, again, if you haven't seen it, go see it. Because like Mike has said, he contemplated ending it where it made it kind of clear that they were still stuck in the Red Room and that none of that really happened. And that would be a very Oculus style ending. The fact that he chose to take the other route that like they kind of did go, the other siblings kind of did go and like live out their lives and they weren't just like stuck in the Red Room. That's a very optimistic ending.
Well, and I know a lot of people do try to like theorize, but Mike has outright said no, that didn't happen, because I think it's like it's Luke's second year of sobriety and he's got like a cake, but the cake is red and everyone's like, oh, the color red, they're in the room.
But
and he's
the
like,
window
it's frosting,
in the back
calm down.
The window in the back is not the all he would have needed to do is put that like skinny window in the back that shows that it's the Red Room. And since that's not there,
or like
not.
Put a silhouette or a shadow of the door or something, but it would have been like more, you know, more obvious. This is, you can tell, like the song playing, the tone of everything, it's happy, it's good. They changed that iconic line of the, you know, line at the end of the book.
Oh, you, it's like you
walked there, walked,
walked alone. That's, hold on, let me hear, I can look it up. But yeah, it's like, whoever walked there walked alone, like what
silence slayed steadily.
The line is almost exactly the same. So the line from both the show and the movie is, for the most part, Hill House has stood for 90/100 years and might stand for 90 more. Within walls continue upright, bricks meet, floors are firm, and doors are sensibly shut. Silence lies steadily against the wood and stone of Hill House. And we who walk here in the book walk alone. In the show, walk together. So he literally just changes the last line and the years. The years are irrelevant. That's more of a story thing.
I remember finding out people were mad about that. And I was like, no, it makes sense to change the line. They changed the like whole tone
that was
of the ending.
But yeah. I thought that the actual line, I think it bookends the series, because I might be remembering it wrong. But I think in episode one, Steven says it the way that walks alone.
He does.
And so, So
because it's a line from his book.
Yeah. So it shows like the progression of like when we start the show, the siblings are like very fractured, like the family is very dysfunctional, and then it goes to like the end where it's like it's almost like Nell gave them permission to keep going on with their lives and not have to be stuck in that like in mourning, and then that's what leads to the change of like togetherness.
It's very like nice. Coco.
Yeah,
like even though the people die, like their memories live on as long as you remember, like you just keep remembering your loved ones and like they live on in you. Also very Life of Chuck.
A very nice thought.
And also it's a really beautiful monologue about forgiveness and about how no matter how much we try as people, we are always to some degree probably gonna hurt the ones we love in some way or another, whether it's minor or major. And this idea of like being able to forgive each other and know that your love is what lasts in the end, you know, within reason.
Well, another thing that I learned today that I think connects to this monologue. So I knew that like the filming of Haunting of Hill House was not the smoothest time. Like Mike has said, it's been very stressful and it was like a very dark time, which almost makes me like feel bad to say that it's my favorite show. But anyway, I learned today that in a scene slightly earlier than this, when so all of the siblings are kind of having their worst nightmares happen and then Nell saves them from it. And in Steven's, his kind of worst nightmare, his like wife or ex-wife or partner in the show, is kind of like attacking like him as a writer. And it was kind of like talking about how he's not a good writer and stuff like that. And apparently like Mike wrote that because those were things that he was thinking about his own writing. And so then this comes later. So it's almost like he's forgiving himself for all of the like beating himself up and all of the like kind of like torture and like depression and whatever. I hope I'm not putting words in his mouth that he was feeling throughout the filming of the show.
No, I do remember we were talking about this right before we started recording. In the Haunting of Hill House Blu-rays, Mike does the director's commentary. And I do remember, it's been a while since I watched them, but I do remember him talking a lot about the experience of it and how hard it was and writing while, because he was writing the show as while they were filming it.
Yeah. So episode. So
I cannot imagine how stressful and how much like imposter syndrome that must have brought on, especially with your like first big major network production.
Oh, so much stress.
So episode 10, which is when Nell's The Rest is Confetti monologue is, I also read this morning, was written around the time that they were filming episode 7, which is like right after probably the most difficult episode to film, like the two storms with the super long shots. But then also like that's just when you're starting to kind of bring things to like the conclusion where the siblings are going back to the house. So I don't know. Take that for what you will.
Oh, sorry, speaking of just the sibling dynamics, before I forget this, and the thing that Kels just mentioned where Nell is going into their nightmare scenarios and kind of pulling them out, there was someone online on like Tumblr or Reddit or somewhere that pointed out with each sibling, the way that Nell like touches them is so specific. Which is really interesting because touch is such a big thing in the show too, especially with Theo's character. And I don't remember what specifically is each interaction, but there's like someone that she just touches their face and someone she'll like grab their hand, and it just like, because you do get a lot of the sibling dynamics with Nell specifically, and it matches really well. So that was just super interesting to me.
And with Theo in particular, Nell kind of like gets her permission before pulling her, grabbing her hand and pulling her out, because their last interaction in person, she like pushes her hand down and forces her to kind of use her powers without her permission. So I thought that was an interesting, like, that now she kind of, Nell has like kind of learned and is like giving her the space that she didn't in life.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Yeah, I never even really clocked that time. I'll have to go back and watch it, because I never clocked the how she pulls them out specifically. Speaking a little bit more about forgiveness, though, I think the part of the monologue where the siblings are also talking, you know, I'm so sorry our last words were in anger. I'm so sorry that I didn't answer the phone, and I'm sorry if I didn't listen. I think it's just really beautiful, because it is not only the things that you would probably want to say to someone who dies unexpectedly, but it's also the things that you want to try to forgive yourself for, I feel like, when you're in grief. And I feel like it's harder to forgive yourself than to accept forgiveness from somebody.
I think this show, too, just with grief in general, does such a good job of tackling each stage of it, that this like final stage we're in is acceptance, and it's just kind of letting yourself be forgiven, and it's a really, really nice place to end.
It makes everything kind of feel like it's come full circle. Like, I don't think that we would have necessarily, or like, I don't think the show would have necessarily been able to have a satisfying ending if it ended in a different way.
Yeah, I agree. I think if we had had an Oculus style ending, I cannot imagine what my feelings on this show would be. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what theme we were talking about, but we did talk about Oculus in an episode, and I went back and rewatched it, and It just, for me, feels so much like we're talking about sibling films or sibling media. It feels so much to me the sibling for Hill House. They feel very similar, the movies, but with completely different endings.
Yeah, like, oh, I remember when...
Yeah.
When I watched the ending of Oculus for the first time, it was like a little bit of like a jarring like shock to my system. And then the movie just ends there. And I'm like, what? What? So Hill House was like that kind of nice like closure to everything. So, yeah, I think Oculus and Hill House together. I mean, even though Hill House is a series, so it's much longer. But I feel like those would make really good companion watches.
Well, and for sure. Mike has said that, like, yes, Hill House is a series. But Hill House is a 10-hour long movie. Like, I feel like that's one that is perfectly fine to binge, because it basically is like, and I think it also has been compared to the It book and miniseries and that kind of like Kids on Bikes feel.
Oh, yeah, so, and then the shifting timelines. Yeah.
Yeah, so I feel like, yeah, it's definitely that and Oculus, with the timelines especially, have a ton in common.
Yeah.
It was like the trial run for this series, almost.
There is a really interesting part of the monologue, because I feel like the rest is following, and they're all very much along the same themes, but there is a part in the monologue, you're right, we've been in this room so many times and we didn't know, all of us, Mom says that a house is like a body, that every house has eyes and bones and stomach, and then she goes to describe what the house was to each person, besides the obvious, like, you know, us revealing the red room having been something different for everybody. What do you think the red room is supposed to be representing in this monologue?
Maybe the red room is representing like things that we do that kind of like take our focus.
So like escapism?
Yeah. I couldn't think of the word, but yeah, there you go. Because yeah, they're all things that they like, their red rooms, with the exception of Luke's treehouse, which Steve can see, so they kind of have a brother moment. All the other red rooms are very individual experiences.
Yeah, I guess it is the confetti, right? Because the rest talks about all the themes and all the important things, and then we start talking about the house. So this is all the things maybe in life that we feel like at the time are important, but aren't really that important. Because being by yourself is not important. Being together is what really matters in the end.
I don't necessarily have an answer to what you just asked, but we have been talking about like sibling films a lot, and The Haunting of Bly Manor is like, I don't think it's described as a sibling show, but they like, they rhyme.
Yeah.
You know? But in The Haunting of Bly Manor as well, the house is still kind of a body. And I feel like the kitchen in that show is sort of used as like the heart. And there's, you know, the way that the rooms are used are very interesting in that as well. And I really like the consistency of that in both shows. It really, I think, adds to both of them and gives them a lot of depth.
In the monologue, it could also be like, not everything has to be a metaphor of something. It could just be like, this is the plot part of the monologue, to give you the twist. Sort of related to the monologue, as far as themes, do you think the only reason that Hugh does not have a room is because plot, like the house is like, somebody's got to be left alive to bring other people here?
Well, I think his version of the red room is just fixing things that are going wrong. So the room, the house doesn't need to give him a room. It just causes issues in the house.
Yeah, you're right. All the black mold.
Oh, that's a big part of it too, is that are we all just having a collective hallucination because this house is full of black mold? Which, you know, we've answered. No, it's supernatural. But that is a big, like, red herring in the journey of figuring out what happened and, like, if Hugh had something to do with these murders or if it was a ghost.
If the red room is the stomach of the house, what do we think the heart of the house is?
Well, in Bly, I would obviously say the kitchen.
The kitchen, yeah.
Maybe
it's just that it's a stomach. Like, it pretends to have a heart, but in reality, it just consumes you.
Well, that, like, foyer area, like, where the chandelier falls into storms, like, I feel like we see them, we flash back to a lot, like, a lot of times with multiple siblings there.
I did like the analogy of forgiveness is warm, like a tear on a cheek. So soft.
Oh.
I mean, it gives you like a tangible reaction.
And then, of course, I loved you completely and you loved me the same. That's all. The rest is confetti.
That's kind of like a good, like, if you were to kind of describe like life and like the human condition, like we have a lot of other things going on that maybe we think are important or feel important in the moment, but really it's just our social connections.
Man, yeah. I really wish, I don't think there would have been a smooth way to put this in, but I really wish that, because that quote, the rest is confetti, ends up in Bly, part of it.
Yeah, with Hannah and Owen.
I wish that somehow Mike could have snuck it into Life of Chuck.
I think it would have fit, and there was a point that I thought he was going to, but that being said, I do want to mention, and this is definitely going to be one that we talk about, probably dedicate a whole several hours to, but Erin's monologue in Midnight Mass, her very last one, she says something very similar, but I don't remember the exact line, but it's about, like, pictures, or, like, fragments of pictures of...
Yeah,
but, yeah, it's very similar, so I feel like, yeah, there's a very, I'm sure it snuck, the idea of it at least snuck in.
Yeah.
Well, and then for, like, this isn't a fully fleshed out thought, but as we were talking, I was thinking about the what's in here, like, the you contain multitudes thing, and I'm like, what if, like, Hill House and all of everything that happened there was just in somebody's brain? Like, that would be an interesting kind of thing to think about, and then, I don't know. I've been thinking a lot so we saw the movie for the fourth time this weekend. And so I've been thinking a lot about like what does the universe that exists inside of my brain, like what kinds of people are in there, and like what, like when I have a panic attack, does that mean that they have an earthquake? So I don't know. A Life of Chuck comparisons are everywhere, I think.
I want to know whose head we're stuck in right now. Can we get them to the hospital?
Satan, probably, I guess. I don't know what's going on in this country.
Anyway, on that note.
Anyway, on that note, the rest is just confetti.
The rest is confetti. And that's the, you know, that's the whole thesis of the show is, you know, you loved me, I loved you the same, all that jazz. And in the end, we're just going to remember that feeling, and that's all we got.
Yeah.
Thank you. I love you guys.
Until next time.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.